Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm your host, Dave Custy. With me today is Wes Guckard. Wes Guckard is a recognized and well-respected expert in the field of traffic engineering and transportation planning. Serving as a technical advisor in the areas of traffic impact analysis, traffic signal design, traffic circulation, access studies, and transit planning, Mr. Guckard has played a major role in over 6,000 projects spanning both urban and suburban areas, primarily in the Mid-Atlantic area. Mr. Guckard has also provided consultation on projects throughout the United States, as well as internationally, including Mexico City, Indonesia, Dubai, South Africa, and Istanbul. Early in his career, Mr. Guckard served for 5 years with the Maryland State Highway Administration Traffic Division. Prior to founding the Traffic Group Incorporated, Mr. Guckard served as a traffic engineering consultant for 8 years. Mr. Guckard has provided consultation on numerous mixed-use projects and transit-oriented developments, each containing 1 to 4 million square feet of development. In addition to Mr. Guckard's technical expertise, as a renowned expert in the field, he is often asked to serve as an expert witness, testifying before county and municipal boards, district courts, and planning commissions on traffic engineering and transportation planning issues. Welcome to Baltimore Internet and Radio, Wes.
Thank you very much, David.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us a little bio in your own words.
In my own words, I've been a Baltimorean my entire life. I attended Baltimore Polytechnic Institute, one of the last classes prior to moving to the Polywestern facility. Following high school, I began to attend the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Found it was not quite what I wanted to do. And at that point in time, the Vietnam War was still going quite hot and heavy, and I decided to enlist in the United States Air Force. I spent 4 years in the Air Force, 18 months in Southeast Asia, and found that 4 years in the Air Force to be one of the most gratifying 4 years of my life. I returned back from the Air Force, worked locally at the National Security Agency, and then began my new career in traffic and transportation planning. Worked for the State Highway Administration and for a number of years, and then began my work as a consulting transportation planner. The work that I undertook there with another consulting firm really formed the basis for how I wanted to move forward in my life as a traffic and transportation planner. So in 1985, I set out for my own company, much like every young entrepreneur does, and started with myself and grew the firm from there. I was fortunate enough to have a very dear friend provide me with seed capital for the first month and never looked back after that point in time. So since 1985, I've had my traffic engineering and transportation planning consulting firm. We provide services to government and municipal agencies around the country. We provide consultation to the private sector developers, mainly in North America, but certainly we do projects all over the world as consulting with architect and engineering and planning firms.
So this is a program about developing business nationally and internationally. Talk about how you started out in getting national and international business with the Traffic Group Incorporated.
That process is one where young entrepreneurs, young business people will find it's always about being at the right place at the right time. It truly is. And it's about ensuring that you treat people the way you want to be treated, because when that happens, people remember you. And that's exactly what happened here. There's a firm down the street from where we're located now in the Natty Bow building called Development Design Group, DDG as they're known. And while they're not known dramatically in the Baltimore area, they are known all over the world for the work that they do. And one of their architects remembered working with me on some projects and called me one day and said, "Hey, Wes, we have a project in Jakarta, Indonesia, and it's a major, major project, and we would like you to come in and talk with us about how you can make the road system work better as we're planning this huge international multi-use project in Jakarta. So that was one where someone remembered me because of the work I did, hopefully because of the way I treated that particular client, called me in, and from that we began to do work on an international basis from one end of the globe to the other.
You know, obviously, you're successful, so you have ways from A to Z of how you achieve that. But initially, since this was all new territory for you, what did you basically do in terms of hiring people and making people have the right positions and that kind of stuff?
When I began the company, clearly I started with myself and started looking to hire very good people. And from the very beginning, Dave, what became extremely important to me and to our business plan was that once I found the right person by doing interviews and finding people and actually going to other people that I knew in the business from previous years, I wanted to make sure that they had really had what is called golden handcuffs. And so I created a culture of work and a culture of treatment of the employees that keeps the employees wanting to work as a team at our company. Interestingly enough, several weeks ago, we have 10-year dinners for people that have been with us 10 years or more. And currently we're about an 80-person company. And so a few weeks ago, we had a dinner down at the River Watch locally here in Baltimore County. And there were about 37, 38 staffers that were at this dinner celebrating 10-year anniversaries of three of our employees. I started looking around and figuring out that of the 37 people that were at the dinner, 30 of them, over 80%, had already been with our firm for 10 years. Mm. That is a testament to the corporate culture that we've created, and it's a testament to how well I think we end up hiring and how we treat our employees as a company. And it's that type of corporate culture that is wildly and hugely important to have a successful business any place, anywhere, anytime. And while I never really thought about it, Dave, a great deal, what it is that we've created a culture that people want to stay. We have quite a few entry-level kind of jobs, and we end up having young men and women come to us out of college that they think our job with us would be a starting point until they can find something better. But the fact is, these young men and women have stayed with us for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 25 years, because our company's almost 30 years old now. They've stayed with us a long, long time because it's must be a decent place to work. There's no question that I'm not paying the highest and greatest salaries. Clearly, if they were looking for a better salary, they would probably be able to go out and find it. But I do give fair benefits, and we have a culture of camaraderie that I think our employees enjoy.
See, it's a basic template of a successful business that I found in doing these interviews, is that employees are respected, they're rewarded, and it also looks good in terms of clients that come back. They see the same people coming in, the people that they work with, they want to work with again. They see them, you know, going up the ladder, and it's very important in maintaining and gaining new clients because, like you said, word of mouth is really important. A client will tell somebody else, oh, you know, these people, they're very good. I worked with Joe there and blah, 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 blah. And so that's very important, I think. Do you agree with that?
There's no question because in the engineering and the development engineering industry, people do turn over on a fairly regular basis. And our developer clients, as an example, they know They know that if they start a project with the traffic group, they can come back 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 10 years later and have continuity, because those employees are generally still going to be there. And unlike other firms where they may begin a project with a particular engineer or analyst, halfway through the project, that analyst may change or that engineer may change, and then they have to re-educate the project manager. Well, that's not something that generally hardly ever occurs in our company. And I think you're right, that continuity, and quite frankly, had not really thought about it until you mentioned it. That continuity is got to be very important. One of the other things that has been mentioned to us is what we do and how we give back in the community, and it is giving back, but in many ways it's just flat out giving to the community. And I've had people, clients that are basically checking us out, go to our website and see what we have done in the community over the years. And when we look back, when I look back, it's substantial. And I'm very, very proud of what we've done and who we've helped and the way we've done that throughout the years.
Well, that's important, too, because you're not just a segmented part of society. You have people, they work in the community, and you work in the community, and your business is in the community. And it's important that you support that. And that's a very good point, that businesses, when they look for a business, they do look for the complete package. And it sounds like that you've, you know, done that for, 28 years or something.
Yes, sir.
One of the things that I saw in researching you is that you're pretty hip on technology. Now, let's go back to 85, when I like talking to companies that started, the other company I talked to started around the same time you did, and they talked about the technology back then as opposed to right now in terms of gaining new clients. Back then, the best thing you could do was fax somebody something. But if you're working on international clients, they researched the business culture. It was very important that they had to meet people. They can't just do it on Skype like you do now. When you meet people, say if you meet somebody in Japan, you have to know the business culture, because you can easily insult them.
Yes.
And not know it.
Yes.
No. So did you have any experience with that? I mean, a lot of your business is national, but it's international too. So you had to kind of think on terms of that. You had to do a big preparation when you were meeting a new client that was international.
I think you mentioned a couple of things. One, you mentioned technology, and the other, you mentioned international culture. There's no question as we started doing work internationally. It was actually pretty fascinating to me as traffic engineers and transportation planners. One of the first things that I thought of, I said, well, wait a minute, could there be that much traffic, as an example, in Jakarta? Or could there really be that much traffic in South Africa? I'm working on a regional mall in Menlo Park, South Africa, in Pretoria. Could there really be that much traffic? And so it was important for us to understand, number one, was there really that kind of traffic? And I think most Americans look at other countries as they cannot be as advanced as we are, when in fact a vast majority of the world is as advanced as we are as it relates to their economies and traffic and transportation, whether it's automobiles or whether it's bikes or whether it is transit, subway or light rail or heavy rail, that type of thing. So it was important for us to have a clear grasp on how those international cultures worked as it relates to traffic and transportation. The second thing that was really important was for us to understand, did they do the traffic analyses in Dubai in the same way that we did the traffic analyses in the United States? And the answer is yes. It's truly one world as it relates to doing traffic studies.
So it's universal.
It really is. And the primary document sources are extremely similar, and the guidelines and procedures are very, very similar. So once we started to understand, Dave, that those types of metrics existed there as they did here in North America, then it became much easier to start to convert from the English system to the metric system, but then all the other mathematics and analysis processes became the same. The other thing you mentioned was technology, and there's no question that our company is really on what a friend calls the bleeding edge of technology versus the leading edge, and by that he always looked at the fact that we were spending pretty substantial amounts of money making sure that we had the latest and greatest, and that we were ahead of the curve, and that we researched new technology as it related to processes, analyses, programs, capacity programs, analysis programs, computer programs, all the way down to the technology that is used to count cars. Because when we began the company almost 30 years ago, the process was dramatically different than it is today. And most people, when they hear that we do data collection or we count cars, they say, oh, yeah, you put the little road tubes across the road. Well, indeed, that's the case, and some of that still exists. But today, we use cameras, we use infrared technology, we use radar technology that counts cars, that classifies vehicles, that looks at the speed of the vehicles. And today, we're using Wi-Fi technology and we're using Bluetooth technology to count, just to count and to track cars. And by that, I mean we set out these boxes that are basically antennas, and we're able to, as someone is walking by or driving by, we're able to give them a specific MAC address at point A, and then we can track them a block, a mile, 10 miles away, and track that same MAC address to see how far they've traveled, how fast they've traveled. Now, we do not know who that person is.
Okay. Have to make that quality.
But we do know that there's a unidentifiable but distinguishable set of numbers that will follow that particular cell phone device and track it from point A to point B. And what's going to happen is that beginning in the next 12 to 24 months, every new automobile that's purchased will have a cell chip in it. Every new car will have a cell chip in it. So we're not sure yet as an industry how that information is going to be used. One can look at it in multiple different ways. One is being, this is great. We'll be able to collect tons of data. You've heard the term big data, mm-hmm. and that's, it's going to be enormous as to the amount of data that's going to be collected from an automobile that's moving. You could look at it as George Orwell, 1984, Big Brother. And in some of that, as you know, is already occurring. Because that happens now out on the street corner, both with cameras and cameras that are tied to traffic signals, because traffic signals now are being monitored by cameras in order to create the best possible interconnection so that traffic signals can be coordinated along the way.
It is fascinating at the same time, if you think about this 20 years ago, that you would be able to do this now to compile, fine-tune all this information, because your objective is the transportation and that information. And for me, too, it's interesting when you talk about getting business internationally. I lived across the pond in Europe for about 10 years, and even the road structures are completely different. Like, I was living in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and it's all roundabouts, not too many traffic lights, you know. And the thing about it is to adapt to that. And my point is that a business that is American based needs to adapt to that, needs to do preparation in terms of when you're doing business over there. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. And what we did, you mentioned roundabouts. I would say it may have been 15 to 20 years ago we actually, when roundabouts started to come in vogue in North America, we hired a consultant in roundabouts from Great Britain and brought him here to the United States and had him train our engineers and our designers on how to properly design roundabouts. And as a result, we actually became one of the first firms in Maryland to start recommending roundabouts and designing them the right way. I can tell you that we'll have folks say to us all the time, hey, did you do the one in Towson? No.
That's what I was going to mention. I was trying to think of one that was there, the one by Barnes & Noble.
Not ours. But, and that one has had a lot of challenges, okay? but over the years, we've, for example, down in Columbia, at the entrance to Maple Lawn Farms, there is a series of roundabouts that we designed for the developer of Maple Lawn Farms. So we know how to properly design, and we were trained by what we think are the very best minds from both Great Britain and Australia, because Australia is another country that was very, very strong on roundabout design and technology. And we're doing the same thing today on what is called diverging diamond interchanges. We designed the very first one that is built and operating, and it's at the entrance to the Arundel Mills Mall for the casino. And it is it's a diverging diamond interchange, sometimes known as a DDI, and it's at Arundel Mills Boulevard at the Baltimore-Washington Parkway. And it's basically running traffic in the opposite direction in order to reduce the amount of delay at the traffic signal and to keep traffic moving. So we did that design, and it really is the first and I think the only one that's been built so far in Maryland. But those types of interchange designs are becoming much more popular. And what we did was to start to visit one or two that existed in North America and then trained ourselves into the proper way to do the design, and they're coming along. So that's new design technology, both roundabouts and diverging diamond interchanges, where we think we were ahead of the curve as it relates to other engineering firms.
The great thing, I think, about roundabouts is its simplicity.
Yes.
And it works. And at first, you know, it's like, God, roundabouts, how can I do this? But it's such a simple methodology. But it works anywhere.
And it certainly
does. In the UK and in Ireland, they've been using it for a long time, and they use it with their new roads, too.
Yes.
Like I was going to mention, the European Union benefited the Republic of Ireland because they built a whole lot of roads. Now, from Cork to Belfast, it used to be 7.5 hours. Now it's 4 hours.
Wow, that's terrific.
So it has been really beneficial, you know, in those terms. One of the objectives in successful business is to be able to forecast the future, mm-hmm. to see when the economy is going to go up or down or whatever, and to be able to diversify your business model so that you can continue to be successful. Talk about that in terms of the recent recession.
Sure. To me and for many of my friends, it was much more than a recession. It was a depression. Mm-hmm. And you'll hear architects say today that still – they have a 50% unemployment rate, architects, 50%. It has been and continues to be devastating for certain members of the real estate development profession like architects. But back in 2007, being able to forecast is magical, and I do not claim to be either a magician or a seer. But what I did do was listen and read and read and listen over and over again. I spend somewhere between 1 to 3 hours a day reading documents, reading news, listening, rereading stuff that's quite frankly on the internet. And I've been doing that for a long, long time, every morning when I get up, first thing I do. And it became clear to me that we were coming upon an economic crisis that was going to be really difficult. And I say that because I lived through and did not enjoy one bit living through the economic recessions that occurred in the late 70s, although the one in the early 90s, the real estate recession in the early 90s, was the one that affected me the most. And it was at that time in 92, 93, when our company had been in existence for 6, 7, 8 years, that I had to step back and lay off some people. And it was the most painful thing I can ever remember having to do in business, was to walk into some of my employees and say, I've got to let you go. And it's not because you're a crappy employee. It's because the whole world, the real estate world, is falling apart. That was during the old court savings and loan situation.
All right.
That brought down much of the real estate in the Baltimore, Washington metropolitan area. And at that point in time, I said that I never want to go through that again, where I have to walk in and to look into somebody's face and know that they've got a family, or even if they don't have a family. Morally, it's what it does to somebody's heart, I cannot imagine, because I've never been through it. But I can imagine that it's just a horrible thing for someone who is trying to take care of themselves, their parents, their family, whatever it is, that they're out of a job. And they're out of a job in a horrible time. So I set out to do my best to never allow that to happen again. And so I went from diversifying the company as a almost 100% company that worked in real estate to something that could be different. And I set out to work both for government and for the private sector. So I had a public-private sector, because at the time I was 10% public, 90% private. And my goal was to get the company over time so that I had a much better circumstance, 50-50 kind of situation, so that if one industry went south, the other industry may be able to pick it up. And at that same time, I had clients that had literally the old adage, all their eggs in one basket. I had architects and friends and engineers that were doing 60 to 70 to 80% of their work with one client. Well, that's like the worst possible thing in the world. So I also forecasted that that could happen again, and I'm never going to allow that to happen. So today, Dave, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about the 2007 depression, but today we are probably 60% government, 40% private sector. So we went from 10% government up to about 60% government, and it's been a really good balance for us. On the other hand, I made sure that we were never beholden to one particular client. Mm-hmm. One, because I don't want him to get ticked off for some reason and fire us, or he goes bankrupt and it ends up bringing us down. So probably our largest client may represent 5% of our total annual revenue, so that we've got that balance now that if we're hurt by one thing, we can recover. No one likes to lose one penny of work for whatever reason, but we're not beholden to any one client under those particular circumstances. Now, turning to the 2007 recession, as I started to say, I read and I said, you know, our business is we've been termed the tip of the spear, and by that I mean we are, before something happens, good or bad, we're going to figure that out. And what became pretty evident is that the work started to drop off before other firms started feeling it. We were starting to feel it because we're so far on the planning end. We're at the tip of when things happen. It's often we have folks say, hey, did you see the paper? Such and such is going to build this mega development. Well, by the time it hits the paper, we will either not be involved at all or will have already been involved, and they're already our client. So we're out there way in front before something hits the paper as it relates to something good or bad happening. Knowing that, I just finished reading a book called The Blue Ocean Strategy, which I highly recommend to any entrepreneur, be them local, national, or international. It's called Blue Ocean Strategy, and it's written by maybe 10 years ago by some Harvard students. And it's all about, do you want to swim with all the other fishes, or do you want to be in an ocean where there's just a couple fishes? And if you're out doing business, do you want to be in a business environment where all the other competitors exist, or do you want to be in a business environment where you're new, you're fresh, you're one of the few? And so that Blue Ocean Strategy book got me thinking, what can I do now and as the economy starts to tank? What can I do now that will help me either through the recession or help me after the recession and after the economy starts to recover? So I started looking around for new sources of revenue, new sources of technology. And what we ended up doing was several things. Number one, we looked at what are the new types of technology that could be used to conduct traffic counts, produce data that government needs in order to make to do their reporting, so they can figure out when their roads are going to fail, so they can program new roads, program fixing the roads, fixing the bridges, so they can program for the future to do their planning studies. And what we did was we looked at what has been and is coming to be huge, and that is toll roads. We're going to be tolling more and more and more roads. And in Maryland, we're just beginning. In other parts of the country, it has really taken off. And so we purchased technology that helped us do toll road studies for what would be called Wall Street-type analyses. So we purchased that technology before anyone else had it, and we were called upon to do these types of special toll road studies around the country. And we were very successful between 2007 and still successful today doing that. The other thing we did was it became very apparent to me that from a transit perspective, light rail and heavy rail was going to start to die in our country because we simply could not afford to build any more subways and very few light rail systems or streetcar systems. So we set out and started studying and visiting bus rapid transit systems around the country and got to the point where pretty quickly we became quite expert in bus rapid transit systems. And today, just in Maryland, we've designed about 200 miles of system in Montgomery County, in Prince George's County. And most bus rapid transit systems may be somewhere from a mile to 5 or 10 miles, but we've been involved in about 200 miles of system so far, and it's going to grow because it's about one-tenth to do a dedicated bus rapid transit system. It's about one-tenth the cost of building a light rail system. BRT, as it's called, or bus rapid transit, is going to continue to grow and, quite frankly, may explode in our country over the next 10 years. There are systems in Brazil and in Central America, in Colombia, that carry more people on a bus rapid transit system than the Washington, D.C. subway carries on a daily basis. So it's going to continue to grow because, one, it's extremely green because you're not doing the disturbing of the environment. And two, you're not necessarily running these buses on electric. Electric comes from oil. You can run these buses on compressed natural gas, as an example.
Oh, really?
And on batteries. And so CNG transit vehicles are extremely green. And anyone who's read a little bit of the news knows that natural gas is what we have an abundance of in our country, and it's only going to continue to grow as well. One final thing that we started doing about 24 months ago was to get very involved in automated and robotic parking. And We did the same thing. We traveled the country. We read. We became deeply involved in understanding how automated parking works and, quite frankly, how green automated parking is, number one. And now the technology has come to the point, Dave, where you are not going to spend much more. You spend a little bit more for automated parking than you would on a ramp garage. But the result is you can get back 30 to 50% of the space, same amount of cars in 30 to 50% of the space as you would a ramp garage. And we're currently in the process of one level or another on about a dozen different projects, automated parking projects around the country.
It is fascinating in terms of starting off when you're talking about employees and how bad you felt laying people off. And then you've translated that into giving people 10-year dinners.
Yes.
Too. And so, you know, that kind of thing is part of a successful business, I think.
Yes.
And to be able to project and determine what the business is going to be and where you need to diversify, too. I mean, those are real key elements. And they pervade when I talk to people like yourself who have successful businesses. These are points that I want to take up in compiling this blueprint to be on a continuous basis here. I think we could do a whole show about rapid transit,
yes.
Rail lines versus the bus line. My feeling is that if cities built the light rails 20 years ago, it would have been better adaptable in terms of cost, and you know, some European cities did.
Absolutely.
Now, and when you talk about the bus systems, I think one of the biggest obstacles you're going to have is getting people to leave their cars home. There's that mindset, I'm not taking the bus at all. But if you've got dedicated bus routes, it's going to be difficult in some cities. In this city, I probably would be, I think, doable. But it just made me think of Belfast, because they're, to compare it here, they're Charles Street, they're St. Paul streets, or old streets that are four lanes, very narrow. And there's parking on each side because there are businesses right there, and they can't take that away. And even with the buses coming down, some of the cars coming toward the buses have to stop for the bus to go. And I don't know what their plan is to do something like what you're talking about in dedicated bus lanes and stuff like that. I don't know what they're going to do that, how they're going to figure that out. But that's just, I'm using that just kind of as a paradigm of some of the problems that you can face. But this is basically a teaser. I'd really like to do a program on that and a program on what I'm going to ask you about now, too, which is robotic parking. Do a little bit about that, because to me it sounds like we're entering Westworld or something like
well,
that.
Well, what we're doing is we're taking technology that has been in use for at least 50 years, Dave. And that technology is used in warehousing around the world. And in warehouses today and for the last 50 years, they've been taking and moving pallets and moving product inside a warehouse using robots that are programmed to go from point A to point B. If you go back to one of your clients and you go to one of the hospitals, you'll see robots are in the halls, for example, of University of Maryland here right now. They use those robots. They fill them with pills and medicine, and they will roam the hall taking pills and prescriptions to the nurses' stations. Hmm. So they will get on the elevator by themselves. They'll talk to you. You're walking down the hall. They'll move out of the way. So robots, even though it sounds like it's Jetsons, is something that's here and it's here to stay. This technology that they've used for all these years in warehousing is something that's been used for years in cars. My partner here, Renata Haberkam, has recently completed a white paper on mechanical parking. And as part of her white paper and her research, she went back to, I believe it's in New York City, back in the 20s, where they had mechanical parking that looked a lot like a compressed Ferris wheel, where you would pull your car in and the next spot would open, you pull your car
right,
in and go on up.
Like
yeah, and so the idea of automated parking has been around for a long, long time and has been used for many, many years. We've gotten to the point now where the technology of the robots and the cost of developing these systems has come in line with standard ramp garages, But the robotic and automated parking is wildly green. And by that I mean you pull a car into what is looks like a garage bay, and then the robot or mechanical system takes the car away. That means that if you have a 500-car garage, you're no longer driving the cars up 4, 5, 6 levels and driving it back down 4, 5, 6 levels.
In a contained space.
Mm. And what you're doing is you're removing about 80% of the pollutants from that would occur in a normal garage. You're removing those 80% of those pollutants by using a robotic garage or an automated garage. Think about just for a moment, every time you make that turn in a garage, you're coming down the ramp, you're putting on your brake. Well, the amount of brake dust that comes out is enormous. The amount of tire dust every time you make that turn is enormous. So you're saving tons and tons of pollutants by using a automated or robotic garage versus a standard garage.
Trying to get my head around it, because when you mentioned something like New York, I was thinking about, I remember years ago going in there, and what they had was like you drove into a big elevator.
Yes.
And they went out and they drove it out to there. But in terms of the robots that are coming out, what do they look like? Are they like a cherry picker or?
No, what it is is that it is a flat plate. It's maybe the size of this table, these two tables combined, okay? Mm-hmm. And the robot runs on wheels, goes underneath, and what happens is the car moves into a tray. The robot moves under the tray, lifts the tray, and then takes it either to an elevator. They still use those. It mm-hmm. takes it to a vertical lift or an elevator, takes it up a level, and then the robot moves the tray with the car on top of it to a parking place. And it's really the technology or the mechanics is really all about the same type of mechanics that are used in people elevators. What has advanced is the algorithms that are used in the computer programs mm-hmm. that determine that the number that you punched in the kiosk when you left your car, the computer algorithm knows where the robot took your car, so that when you get back, you punch in your code again. The robot knows where that car was parked because it has a specific code, finds the car, lifts the car, brings it to the elevator, brings it down the elevator, and deposits it, turned around the right way out, to what looks like a garage, a small garage.
So how easy is it to convert garages that we have now, or do you have to raise them and build a whole new one?
Converting, it depends. There are systems that are being used that are going to start to convert old garages, but it's more likely that you're either going to start fresh versus building or doing an adapted situation. And it depends on the geometry, the height of the garage, the kind of ramps that exist. It's not out of the question. We're doing some concepts for conversions, but it's going to be a little more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, starting out, I guess it's somewhat expensive, but it gets matched by, like you say, the green effects, and also, you know, in time, you know, that it'll
be paid
for itself.
And land saving. One, and they're much faster, mm-hmm. much faster. The average pickup time is about 2.5 minutes to get a car out of a automated garage. And you think about that versus going into a standard ramp garage where you're going up to an elevator, waiting for the elevator, taking the elevator up, walking to your car, maybe finding your car, going click, 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 where did I leave it? So you find your car, then you get in your car, you back out, then you work your way down the garage. That takes much longer than 2.5 minutes on the average. So we're going to save time. As it relates to security, there's nothing better. Mm-hmm. The Department of Justice has reported that 40% of all rapes occur in a garage.
My God.
All of that goes away. Your car is untouched by human hands, so there's no scrapes, no dings. We're not dealing with parking attendants. And you're dealing with a situation where the person waiting to pick up their car. They're in a little room, in a little closed area, maybe the size of this particular studio, and you're waiting with other people. So it's not a circumstance where someone can hide inside the garage to either steal or accost someone. So the security is 100%. It's a secure, green, safe environment that saves land and saves space for everyone involved.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting a list of priorities.
Good.
What else do you want to talk about in terms of your current work? And then we'll do a little bit of projecting what you want to see your business doing.
Sure. Our current work is one where we're working for 7 to 8 State Department of Transportation around the country. We have a presence in New York State, Virginia, West Virginia, Maryland, of course, both of the Carolinas, a large presence in Arkansas, a huge presence in Texas. And those are states that we are working on and have worked on for many years. We're working on some of the major projects in the Baltimore-Washington region. We've been helping the casino here in Baltimore at Caesars Casino, the Horseshoe Casino down in Baltimore. We've been working with MGM on their casino that they're hoping to build at National Harbor down in Washington, D.C. And we're working on all of the major mixed-use developments throughout the Baltimore-Washington area. We're real proud that we think that we're among the first to be called when there's a major project. And quite frankly, we've been told that clients will call upon us for the tough stuff. It's one thing, and there are a lot of great engineers. There are a lot of great traffic analysts. A lot of that work can be sometimes a bit ho-hum. But when the tough stuff, when the hard things need to be fixed or need to be examined or need to have some outside-the-box thinking, we think that we get a call very, very early on for those types of clients based upon relationships and reputation that our engineers have built over the last 25 years.
Basically, you want to continue with the robotic garages and build on what you are doing right now and hope that you don't have to diversify again.
That's interesting that you mentioned that, because we're getting ready to do some more of that. Mm-hmm. Because what's coming next is connected vehicles. And by that, I mean you see it today on advertisements of cars that are stopping before you even know that there's something in the way.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's going to happen over the next 5 years is that all the auto manufacturers are going to be building vehicles that are basically communicating with one another. Ultimately, and probably not in my lifetime, hopefully in your lifetime, we'll have autonomous vehicles, the Google cars, where they're self-driving vehicles. So we're going to spend the next 12 to 24 months doing a tremendous amount of research on what connected vehicles are going to mean to our industry as a traffic engineering and transportation planning industry. Then, after we have a clear understanding of that, because there's going to be a tremendous amount of big data being collected by these cars that are connected to one another. And I say connected, they're communicating with one another all the time. Once we understand what that means, Dave, the plan is to take and identify over the following 12 to 24 months how that fits into our business plan and our business model. So that within the next 5 to 6 years, we expect that our company will develop a business model and a set of criteria and technology that can keep us going for the next 30 years. For all of the younger folks that are in our company, because we have a young company, and I would venture to say that the average age of the employees in our company is 35 years old. And so I want to make sure that my legacy is our company continues to exist. I do not want to have a company that dies when I die. I want that company to continue to grow and be part of the region, part of the world, and quite frankly, continue to be part of our great society.
It's a great way to end it. Good. So now we have three shows. We have public transportation, we have robot garages, and we have connected cars. And I appreciate you thinking that I'm a lot younger than you, but I'm not really so.
Okay.
And hopefully in both our lifetimes we will see that. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, I think I'm talked out for now.
Very good. So why don't you give some contact info and tell us where you're located. You said down the street from Natty Bo, but hopefully there are millions of people out there that don't know where that is.
Sure.
Maybe they'll come visit you.
We are our office, our primary office is located in White Marsh, Maryland. Contact is 410-931-6600. We can be found on the internet, obviously, at trafficgroup.com, just trafficgroup.com. Can be found on the internet. We have built what we think is a pretty wonderful internet site that has just about any type of information possible. Our YouTube channel will, I think, be very interesting to a lot of folks who are interested in traffic engineering and transportation planning. So go to our YouTube channel on at our website at trafficgroup.com.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks, Wes. Thanks for coming into Baltimore Internet Radio. I've been talking to Wes Guckert, the owner of Traffic Group Incorporated. This is Dave Custy, and you've been listening to Baltimore Internet Radio.